So Friday morning, I was sitting in Starbucks, my favorite Starbucks, and I'm sitting there with my nondescript red cup. And I'm sitting there and I put my earbuds in. I try and zone out and not pay attention to anyone else, but you just can't help it. Sometimes, you know, someone at the next table is talking and you happen to overhear it. And I heard someone turn to someone and say, with all sincerity, "Happy winter solstice to you." I almost spit my coffee out. I'm like, is that a thing? Happy winter solstice? And I actually looked it up. I was like, is this person just being funny? Is this like, and I actually looked up, they actually sell winter solstice greeting cards. How do you respond to that greeting, by the way? Well, merry tilt of the earth to you, and to all a joyous rotation around the sun. This is the naturalistic, nature-only, materialistic Christmas greeting. Yeah. Listen, I get it. I know if you don't believe in Jesus, and some of us might not in here, so I'm just... If you don't believe in Jesus, Merry Christmas can be kind of awkward. But the length to which we've tried to de-godify, to take God out of this festive season, is actually laughable. We now live in a place, in a country, in a world that wants all the symbols of Christmas. We want the candy canes and the stars, and we want the trees, and we want the festive lights and the sacred music and the goodies, and we want the celebration, and we want all the symbols of it, but we've drained all of the meaning out. We've tried to separate it, the symbol, from the referent. Do you know how crazy this is? This is like a single woman wearing a wedding ring because she thinks it looks pretty. This is like a bunch of Russians like letting off fireworks on the 4th of July and not knowing that it's about the birth of America. Like, this doesn't make any sense. At some point you got to look at each other and be like, what are we celebrating here? So recently I saw a picture that I really thought this will become the new icon of American holidays. It's this right here. It's a picture that you can see whatever you want to see in it, right? To the Christian, this is the nativity. It's Joseph and Mary worship before our newborn king. But to the naturalist, it's an epic battle scene of two bloodthirsty T-Rex fighting to the death in front of a running saw blade. Can you see it? Here. You'll never look at that picture the same, will you? Listen, I am a pastor, but I'm not that guy. You know that guy. That guy who always writes Christ in all caps when he writes Christmas. I'm not that guy. I'm not that guy looking for meaning behind every single tradition. Like, Frosty the Snowman is a magical snowman, and I'm okay with that. Christmas trees were probably something from the Druids more than they are a Jesus tree, and I'm okay with that, right? You know, as a pastor, people ask me all the time, like, what do you tell your kids when it comes to Santa Claus? And I'm just like, I tell them the truth. He is a third century saint who gave away gifts secretly at night. You would leave little bags of gifts on your windowsill and down your chimney. He supposedly, reportedly, did miracles. And when he met the famous heretic Arius, he heard that Arius did not believe that Jesus was fully God, so he walked across the room and slapped him in the face. This is my favorite picture of him, in fact. This is immortalizing jolly old St. Nicholas, open hand slapping the heretic. Brings whole new meaning to, you better be good for goodness sake. So I'm not trying to over-spiritualize things. I'm not trying to shove my religion down anyone's throat. I get it, but I'm just making an open observation. Christmas in America is completely godless. Now let me measure my words here. I don't mean godless in the sense of, like, you take goats and you sacrifice them to some pagan deity in your backyard. No, not that godless. And I don't mean godless even in the sense of, like, if you tell false truths about Jesus, Saint Nick will punch you in the face. No. No, I'm talking about godless and simply the fact that God is missing. He's gone. Like, you look around and he's gone. It's without God. everywhere you go. And I'm pretty sure that this is not just a seasonal thing. It seems to me that if you pay attention, God is missing, well, pretty much from everything in America these days. So, in a few days, we're going to be in Florida. This is our family vacation. My grandmother owns a house in Pine Island, Florida, way down there by like Naples on the Gulf side. It's an island and there's fishing and we're on a canal. And the forecast for Christmas Day is 88 degrees and sunny. And I don't know about you who like a white Christmas, but that is my ideal Christmas forecast right there. And before you get too jealous, though, realize that we are actually driving in a car there. So me, my wife, and two kids fighting the whole way for 21 straight hours. This is part of my parenting strategy. I'm teaching my kids to suffer well. And our Christmas tradition, we've done this, this will be our third year now. Christmas tradition is that every year when we go on this trip, my wife, she worries about packing everything for everyone. And I worry about which books I'm going to pack. It's my favorite tradition. And so it's a good deal for me. And so this year, I found a few gems. Like, I don't know about you, but for me, the measure of a good vacation has a lot to do with the books I bring. I don't know if you can relate. You probably can't. Maybe you can. But for me, this is a really, really important decision. So I've been asking around and doing some research, and I asked one of my friends, you know, what would you recommend? And one of my friends recommended this gem. It's a 2008 New York Times Book Review of the Year book. It's called Nothing to Be Afraid Of. And the other day, I ordered it on Amazon. It came in the mail. And I'm like, kid at Christmas. I open up my package and I'm like smelling my book and gently folding back the pages. My wife's like, you're weird. And I'm like, I love it. And she's like, okay, so you got your great book that you're going to read. What's it about? And I was like, it's awesome. It's this philosophic reflection on death by someone who doesn't believe in God. And my wife's like, that's chipper. My kind of vacation book. Maybe it's not your kind of vacation book, but listen, the first line from the book from this man who doesn't believe in God, who gives a reflection on death, his first line of the book is this: I don't believe in God, but I miss him. I don't know about you, but that's it. Like, if there's a sentence that describes this, America, Christmas 2015, New York Times best-selling books. If there's something that describes our world right now, it's this: I don't believe in God. Like, a lot of us say we believe in God, but functionally, we do not believe in God. Like, he's completely missing from our schools, from our laws, from our education, from our political conversations, from our homes. He's completely absent. Like, you could go through days and weeks and months of your life and never even consider God in America. But we miss him. Like, we're haunted by the fact that all around us is littered religious artifacts everywhere. These symbols, these great symbols pointing us to God. Like, it's in our Constitution. It's on our money. It's echoed in our laws. It's our Bill of Rights, right? We find these rights, these inalienable rights. Where do they come from? They're given from our Creator. Our calendar. Who came up with the 7-day week? Oh, wait, yeah, that was Genesis 1. We're 2015. That's 2015 years from what? Oh, that's right. So symbols of God are everywhere. Signs of his work are everywhere. And yet God is like absent. It's like a ghost town. It's like you come into the town and you're like, there used to be someone here, but he's not here anymore. And man, oh man, no time do we find it more than when you're sitting at Starbucks with your nondescript cup at the most wonderful time of the year and everyone's like, happy winter solstice to you. I don't know about you, but yes, Julian Barnes, I miss him. Like, I do believe in God. I'm a pastor. I'm paid to believe in God. Of course I believe in God. But man, it's easy to miss him. You know, I am paid to read my Bible and talk to you about Jesus. And yet I find it rather difficult to remember that God is at the center of everything. I don't know, maybe it's just me. But I happen to think that if I wasn't actually paid to do what I do, it would be so easy to go days and weeks and maybe years of my life and never once give a thought to the God who made me. Which leads us to our text today. This is why we so desperately need to hear from Matthew, at least I do. Matthew is he's one of the earliest biographers of Jesus, but he's not just that. He's a man who met Jesus. He was a sinner. He was a tax collector. He was hated. He met Jesus. Jesus smashed into his life and changed him forever. And then he spent the rest of his life, even died for the cause, to tell people about this kingdom of God, this great king who changes everything, who's this God who's entered into our world, this God who is with us, who's not absent, even though we might not see him. And I'm telling you, I'm just from personal experience, it is hard to find a guide who would be better at this than Matthew. If you're looking for someone to lead you on how do you find God in the midst of history and politics and crazy leaders and refugee crises and atrocities and mass killings, if you're looking for a guide to show you where is God in the middle of our hurt and our pain and our consumerism and Star Wars and whatever else is coming up, you can hardly do better than Matthew. Matthew chapter 2 is our text. Matthew chapter 2, if you have a Bible, I encourage you to join along. All the key text up here today. Matthew chapter 2, he's got a story for us, but this is a Christmas story. And for most of you, this is going to be a little bit familiar, but we're gonna look maybe a little beyond where you're used to looking. So Matthew chapter 2, starting in verse 1, goes like this. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, hopefully that's familiar to you, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." And we know this story. We got it, Matthew. We like this story. These are, you know, the Magi. We three kings of Orient are, right? We know these guys. We have them in our lawn nativities. We sing songs about them. But if you actually kind of probe into this and do like your historical background type stuff and you ask, now who exactly are these Magi? If you press me on it, I'll say, I really don't know. No clue. Could it be that they are, here's the theory, Zoroastrian prophets who received a prophecy about a rising star from Numbers chapter 24 through the ancient Jews who remained in Babylon, influenced by Daniel? Maybe. And if that's helpful to you, great, you go study that. But that's not Matthew's point. You see, the thing is when you come through this, the Magi, when they show up in Matthew chapter 2, they're mysterious. Nobody knows who they are. People didn't know who they were back then. People don't know who they are today. That's not what Matthew's talking about. But there's a reference in here that everybody in Matthew's day would have known. And it's that Jesus was born during the time. Oh, here's my Magi picture. So here's my favorite one. I let my kids put together my PowerPoint this time. So, what it meant to be born during the time of King Herod. Okay, let's put this in perspective. Jesus' life, he lived, I don't know, 33 years. We say 33 years. It's probably a little longer than that, just FYI, but we say 33 years. So, the first 30 years, right, we have how many chapters on in the entire scriptures, we have 3 chapters on the first 33 years of his life. And if you go through those 3 chapters and you study them carefully, one of those chapters is dominated by a man named Herod. This chapter right here that we're talking about. Of everything you need to know about Jesus for 30 years of his life, the vast majority of the years he spent walking on earth, Matthew's going to stop us and say, if you want to know about who this Emmanuel is, this God with us, this boy king, you need to see this. Like, there's something about this guy. Like, if you want to understand what God is up to in the Christmas story, what God is up to in our broken, hurting world of mass killings and refugees, et cetera, et cetera, you need to meet a guy who is evil, pompous, prideful, godless, and would shape an entire nation. You need to meet King Herod, Herod the Great. So let's do a little background here. Herod was an Edomite, which, don't worry about that. Just know he's an Edomite, okay? He was an Edomite, his father half Edomite, half Jew. And he had some very, very powerful friends. You may have heard of them. Cleopatra, Mark Antony, Caesar Augustus, personal friends of his. When he was a young man, some stuff happened, and we discovered that he has, right off the bat, he has an absolutely, like, scary, smart, brilliant mind, and an ego that would make Donald Trump look humble. All right? Massive, huge ego. Okay, so 44 BC, what happens? Julius Caesar's in there, and if you've ever been to the Roman Forum, you know the spot. Julius Caesar is there, and he's like, "E tu, Brute," and all the senators come, they stab him, kill him, Caesar's dead, chaos ensues, and Herod sees his golden opportunity. He's a young man at this point, so he jumps into that chaos, and he pays a few people off, he calls in a few favors, he kills a few people, and somehow manages to get the Roman Senate to declare him prefect of Palestine. That means he's going to be the king of this region where Jesus would be born. All right, so fast forward just a few years, 37 BC, he now shows up in Jerusalem with this vast Roman army behind him and says, "Behold, your king has arrived. I'm the one you've been looking for all these years." To which the people are like, "A, you represent Rome, foreign oppression, and B, you're an Edomite, ergo, you're not a son of David, ergo, you're not a Jew, ergo, you can't be the one we're looking for." And he does what any king would do to win people over. He then systematically kills tens of thousands of people until they all agree, "Yes, you're the king we're looking for. Yes, yeah, that's what I wanted. Who knew?" And then, to raise morale even more, he sends assassins out into the countryside. And anyone who complains about him literally gets crucified. The worst region hit was the area called Nazareth, where Jesus grew up. So, the Roman Senate hears about this. This man has brought, let's put this in context. Herod brings peace to the Middle East. Do you understand? This is a battle that's been going on thousands of years, and no one's been able to tame this beast. Herod comes in and does it. All right? The Roman Senate, they're so excited that they rename Herod from prefect of Palestine to Herod, king of the Jews. And the Jews say, "Well, there's one little problem with calling you the king of the Jews. It's God." Yeah, see, God promised 2 Samuel chapter 7 that the king of the Jews who would come 1,000 years earlier, he had promised that the king of the Jews that would come would be a son of David, and you're a son of Edom. That, do you understand? Herod doesn't meet the most basic qualifications. And just to show you the creativity of this man, when he found out that he didn't qualify to be their king, he went in and said, you know, like, normally this would be like an insurmountable thing, right? Like, I'm born from the wrong lineage. What can I do? But he goes in, he burns down the genealogical library and writes his own genealogy. Like, the sheer audacity of a man who's like, "I can rewrite history, sure, no problem." This is Herod. This is the Herod. It was during the time of King Herod that the Magi from the East came to Jerusalem and they asked, "Where's the one who's been born king of the Jews?" When Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all of Jerusalem with him. Like, okay, so you get the idea. Herod's disturbed because Herod doesn't like to hear anyone would challenge his throne, right? Now, why is Jerusalem disturbed with him? Let's paint a little broader picture here. There are a few things you need to know about Herod. Is one, he did his massive building campaigns. You know, he built more things than had been built since the time of King Solomon. So cities and fortresses and palaces and all this grand stuff. He remade the Jewish temple into like one of the wonders of the ancient world. He brought peace to the Middle East. But That's not what he's so much known for. He's known for how many people he executed. So the Sanhedrin, a group of about 22 guys at the time, he killed 7 out of every 8 of them and replaced them. That's the Jewish ruling council. Let's talk about his family. So he was married, actually had 10 wives, but his favorite wife was Miriam. And he said every time he'd go on a trip, he'd say, "Now, if I don't make it back, I want you to kill her." And the reason is because he couldn't imagine anyone else with her. But then one time he got back from a trip and heard a rumor that she was plotting against him. So, yeah, he had her killed anyways. But he took her brother, his brother-in-law, and made him into the Jewish high priest. You know, he wanted someone who he could control in the priesthood, so he sets him up, and he's a 17-year-old kid, and he just nails it. Like, "I'm the coolest priest you've ever seen." If you read Josephus, he literally becomes a teen heartthrob. All right? This is the Zac Efron of Jewish high priests here. And he's like, he's up there, and when he wins, like, this popularity contest, Herod gets so jealous that he has him drowned. And then as he ages, his three eldest sons, they all start vying for who's going to take over when dad's gone. And he hears the rumor that they're actually talking about dad being gone someday, so he kills all three of them. That's just his family. There's a famous quote, we don't know if it's true or not, but it's attributed to Caesar Augustus. It said, "It's better to be Herod's pig than his son. Better chance of surviving." This is the Herod that everyone hears. Somebody's challenging Herod. Oh no, what's this man gonna do? He's willing to kill his wife, to kill his kids, to kill his brother-in-law. There's no one he will not kill for his will to be done. What's he gonna do? We read, verse 4, he has a Bible study. When he had called together the people's chief priests and the teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written." And they pull out this 700-year-old scroll, and they read from Micah 5, it says, "But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means the least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." They say, this is it. This is the prophecy. This is where the promised one is to come from. And so Herod hears this, and here's the question. Herod is a man who every time something goes wrong, he just kills the people that get in his way, right? But this time, he hears there's a threat. There's a baby to be born, and instead he decides to stop and have a Bible study. Let's read some Old Testament scriptures. Why is Herod deciding to have a Bible study? There's a story. Do you guys know Mark Twain? Author of Huck Finn and the other Tom Sawyer. Mark Twain, he was a famous, I don't know if you know this, but he's famously irreligious. A lot of his quotes are mocking Christianity, mocking people who believe in God and things like that. And the story goes that one day he was sitting in his room and someone walked in on him and they found him reading his Bible. And they're like, "Mark Twain, what are you doing? Like, why would you be reading your Bible?" And he, without even thinking about it, quipped, "I'm looking for loopholes." That's what Herod's doing. Why is Herod breaking out the Bible at this time? He's looking for loopholes. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go worship him." Wink, wink. Right? And if you know the story, what happens? The Magi, they go off and they indeed do find the Christ child. They give him gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And we don't know if there are three of them or are there many more, but those are the presents they give, right? But then an angel warns them in a dream and they avoid Herod, and they come back. And what happens is Herod's sitting there waiting for them to come back, and they never show. When the Magi had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said. "Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So when the Bible study fails, Herod goes back to his old ways, and he does what he always does. He kills anyone who gets in his way. Verse 14. So he got up, and the child took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. So let's just lay this out here. There's this megalomaniac leader, this man who's so full of himself, who thinks he can rewrite history and take on God. There's this helpless little family scared to death that are running in fear, sent off as refugees. And there's executioners coming their way. If we were to stop and ask right now, let's reflect on this. If you were to ask Herod in this scene, Herod, what are you doing? What would Herod say? I think he'd say, I am going to kill this boy before he becomes a king. And if you were to ask Joseph, why are you running to Egypt? Why are you a refugee right now? I think he'd say, there's this madman, this megalomaniac. He's coming after me. He wants to kill my son. But if you were to ask Matthew, why is this happening? Why is Herod doing this? What's Joseph doing? Do you know what he's going to say? And so was fulfilled what the Lord said through the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. Matthew, why did this happen? Matthew doesn't see it the way Herod sees it, and he doesn't see it the way Joseph sees it. He sees God at work. He says that 700 years prior to this moment, the reason why Herod's chasing him, the reason why Joseph is running to Egypt, is because 700 years before this day, God declared through the prophet Hosea that this must happen. That God declared that the inauguration of his king, that his son who would become king, would begin with him coming out of Egypt. You guys know the story of Exodus? Seen the movie? The recent movie was terrible. Don't see it. But you get the idea. The Exodus, it's like God's people were down enslaved to a wicked king named Pharaoh in Egypt, and God set them free, released them from slavery out of this land. And that's how he saved for himself a people. And God is saying at this time through the prophet Hosea that there's going to come one, his son, who someday is going to go into Egypt, and then he's going to get called out of Egypt. And when he's called out of Egypt, it's going to start a new exodus, that a new people of God are going to be born, that there's going to be a new relationship with God. Just the same way that the old relationship was founded at Mount Sinai, there's going to be a new relationship formed, but not with some mountain and not some law. The law is going to be written on our heart, and it's going to be start on the day when the Son of God is called out of Egypt. Do you see that? Just the practical nature of this here. God needed, according to his own plan, he needed Jesus to be in Egypt, to be called out in order to fulfill this prophecy. So how does he achieve that? He lets Herod go crazy. Do you get the irony here? Herod's plot to kill Jesus is God's plot to fulfill prophecy. Herod's plans to stop the ancient prophecies actually fulfill the ancient prophecies. Herod's doing all that he can to set himself free from God, but in this, he's only acting as the servant of God. Gets better. Watch this. Verse 16. When Herod realized that he'd been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Can you imagine? I mean, we've got a nursery up there that's out there that's like got like 50 kids in it by now. So like all of you have babies. You can't imagine. Can you imagine one getting killed? Now imagine every boy under the age of two being killed in an entire community. If you were to go back then and you were to ask the people who went through that, what has Herod done? Like, there's some things that you can't even put into words. Watching children be massacred. This is mass killing at a way that guns actually seem nice compared to this. This is terrible. What has Herod done? You ask Herod, what have you done? He'd say, I fought God and won. But if you ask Matthew, what has Herod done? He says this. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled, and he starts singing a song. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning. It's a song that's not familiar to most of us, but it's a song that every Jew who went to synagogue would have known. It's Jeremiah chapter 31. It's like one of the most famous songs in all of the Old Testament. It's this prophecy. It's this crazy, awesome, wonderful prophecy of Jeremiah where he has this vision. He goes to sleep one night, and in Jeremiah chapter 31, he sees this vision of God's promise for his people, and it begins like this. There's this terrible desert land, and there's this huge mass of desperate people, and it says the women are in labor, they're pregnant, and men are hunched over, and people are in pain and hurting and broken, and this crowd of desperate, broken people are walking through the wilderness, and then it says, God says over them a blessing. And when the voice of God is heard from the desert floor, the streams begin to fill and everything starts to blossom and grow around them. And then as they walk along, God sings a song and says, I'm bringing you home. And it says at that moment, one young girl in this terrible crowd of people starts to dance. And then another, and then another, and then another, and all the young women are dancing. It says, and the young men begin to laugh, and then the old men begin to laugh. And right as it breaks into this awesome celebration, God is bringing us home. He's bringing us home. He hasn't forgotten us. He's bringing us home. There's the one sad, terrible line in the middle of this song, and it goes, a voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning. It's a reference to Rachel, the wife of the great patriarch Joseph of Israel, that his children were killed and decimated. And if you look at that reference, you could say, well, yeah, is that what Matthew's talking about here? This is a reference to that, is the great sorrow of Rachel weeping over her children. The children of God, God's people have been killed. Is that what Matthew's saying? Yes, but Matthew knew that that's the only sad line in a song of celebration. The very next line goes like this. Restrain your voice from weeping and your eyes from crying. Stop crying, for your work will be rewarded. There is hope for your future. Your children will return to their own land. I'm bringing you home. I'm bringing you home. I'm bringing you home. That in the middle of the song, there's one thing that's different from everything else. It's this line, that the sign, the moment, the marker, that God is going to bring a new relationship, that he's going to bring his new people home through this new exodus, that there's going to be streams of people going through the desert, coming to meet God for the first time. The sign that God is about to begin the new exodus is a great tragedy, a great sorrow, where children will be killed. And Matthew sees what Herod's done. He says, Matthew, what has Herod done? This is it. This is what Jeremiah is saying about. This is what we've been waiting for 700 years. This is the celebration that God is going to bring to himself. People from every tribe and tongue and nation. And they're going to flood in. There's going to be so many people that we're going to have to set up these signs, these road posts in the middle of the desert. That we're going to have to send someone out to the desert. And he's going to have to prepare the way of the Lord. Because so many people from all over the world are going to come into this new kingdom. This new relationship with God. And the sign that that will happen is a day of great mourning. What has Herod done? His plot to stop Jesus from becoming king has become the very means by which God prepared the way. Do you understand that he worked so hard to remove God from our world, and he ended up serving God's purposes, that he tried to destroy Christ, and he ended up destroying himself in the process? Look at verse 19. After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who are trying to take the child's life are dead. So there's an ancient historian named Josephus. Have you ever heard of him? You guys ever read ancient historians? Herodotus, Josephus? Anyways, His stuff on Herod is really fantastic. He has an explicit description of Herod's end. He describes his condition at death as this. He says, "He was driven mad by paranoia, depression, and fits of rage. His body convulsed and shook violently. Parts of his body began to putrefy, and maggots could be seen in his flesh. The smell of his breath and rotting body was so bad that servants were in danger of fainting in his presence." And in this condition, Herod's been utterly defeated by God. In this condition, facing death, do you know what he did? He's still trying to find a way to plot his own immorality. As he's facing death, he had his three sons killed, and then he gave a command that on the day that he should die, every one of the nobles across the land should be slaughtered, so that there would be mourning for him all across the land. Luckily, thankfully, after he died, he was ignored. So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. And this is going to start with Herod's death. I want you to see this. 1,000 years before, God had promised that a son of David would come, one named Emmanuel. 700 years before, God had promised that there's going to be this new exodus, that out of Egypt I'm going to call my son. And when I call him out, that's going to start something. That's going to start this flood of people from every tribe and tongue and nation. And the marker that that's about ready to begin is there's going to be this great wailing and weeping and mourning in this town of Bethlehem. The children of God are going to die, but then the son of God is going to be called out of Egypt. And we are going to see the world come to know God in a way that they never have before. And with Herod's death, the clock begins. But when he had heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, Archelaus is the son of Herod, he was one of the sons who lived. He was afraid to go there, and having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So he's planning on going back to Israel, and oh no, his plot is now foiled by the son of Herod, Archelaus. Matthew, what's going on here? I thought God's word was getting fulfilled. Oh yeah, but that was to fulfill what was said through the prophet, that he will be called a Nazarene. Do you get it? Herod spent his whole life, he's this megalomaniac who's trying to buck up against God, remove God from the world, trying to destroy everything God is doing in his kingdom. And every move he makes forward to try and destroy God, he actually serves God's purpose. And then when he dies, his son takes his place as the servant of God, fulfilling the prophecies of God. So what's this story about? Merry Christmas! Herod's terrible. Ugh. If you were to ask a historian, what's this story about, right? They say, well, this is about this megalomaniac leader, and they would go through this description of all the politics, the brutal politics of the time. If you were to have send a news anchor back then, right there, and you were to have a modern news anchor evaluate the story, what would be the headlines? The headlines is mass killing. Children are killed in this town. We're familiar with that headline, right? Mass killing. If we were to ask a humanitarian aid organization to go there, or an NGO, what would they do? Their headline would be, there's a refugee crisis. Right? People have to flee from Herod because he's so terrible. All of this is true, right? Herod's a megalomaniac, terrible leader. There is mass killing. There is a refugee crisis. All of this is true. And all of this, if you listen... all of this is oddly, oddly contemporary, isn't it? Look at the news. Look at the message. Look at what people are saying. Christmas, not year zero, Christmas 2015. What's the story? Megalomaniac leaders, mass killings, refugee crises. It's the same story. But if you ask Matthew, what's this story about? He doesn't, it's not that he doesn't see all that. He sees all that. He sees the evil. He sees the hurt. He sees the atrocities. He sees the doubts. He sees the pains. But he also sees something that no one else can seem to see. He sees God. He sees God's hand at work in everything. In the horrors and the atrocities. In the pain and the doubt and the hurt. In Herod's reign of terror, he sees God at work. In the darkest moments, the death of children, he sees God hasn't abandoned us. He hears God's song of hope. In the very place where it feels like God is nowhere to be found, in this Egypt as a refugee, he sees God's preparing the way for his greatest work yet. He sees what he told us about one chapter earlier. He sees God with us. Notice, exact same story everyone else sees, but Matthew has eyes to see it. The question for Matthew is not, is God at work among us? Is God here? The question is, can you see him? Can you see him in your life, in your work, in your family, in the headlines? Do you see God, or do you just see chaos? Do you see hurt? Do you see the next headline? You know, the reason Matthew was able to see, I think, more than maybe most of us is because he met him, right? God with us wasn't an idea to him. It's a person named Jesus. And when he placed his faith in him, he placed his faith not only that he came to save us, but in his promise, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. And that even when we might not have that perspective that Matthew has, when we don't know how to make sense of a refugee crisis or a mass killing or a megalomaniac leader, we can be confident in the promise that God is with us. Merry Christmas and happy winter solstice.